Well, this is Lo-Fi Lit.
I'm your host, Tyler Byrne. This is a podcast where I interview writers, authors, poets, and even essays. Today, I'm talking to Charles Jinson. Okay, this guy, very impressive. I reached out to him. He had a new book coming out, Splice of Life. But it's built with essays of his life. And every paragraph or every few paragraphs will cut in an analysis of a film which parallels with the memoir happening in his life. And you as the reader connect, your own analysis of what's happening in between the essay and in between the memoir. And for me, I related to the book because he's queer, he's gay, and it's one of the first books, I guess, like set in a generation right above me of him coming up in the 90s. And I had not read that or essays like that specific time frame before. Very excited. Go buy Splice of Life. All right. Bye. And you're a hardcore blogger like that.
Are you talking about the Kinema Poetics blog?
Yeah.
Yeah. I did that for a long time.
There we go. Recording started. Okay, let me do the thing. This is Lo-Fi Lit. I am here with Charles Jinson, who is the writer of Splice is Life, a memoir in 13 film genres. Thank you for joining me today. I looked up your old blog, because in the book, which is really good, you talked about, in one of the essays, you wrote about one of your ex-boyfriends and something they went through, but you were talking about you had a lot of time on your hands being a college admissions guy. And I was just thinking, I wanted to find this. You went to college for cinema and your interest in cinema, but then you became a poet. And I wanted to find something that branched those two things together. And I feel like this blog that I found really, it does that. And how did you get interest in poetry after you went to school for film?
Well, I'd actually been writing poetry long before then. I started when I was 13. And the person that I dedicated the book to, Pat Oliver, was my English teacher in high school. And she, I really credit her with making me feel like it was something I should do. So when I was in her class, she asked me to stay after one day. And she said, hey, the poems that you're writing for class are really good. Why don't we work on them together? And, have craft talks about it. So I just spent all of high school feeling like writing is something that I should do. And I did do that during college too. I continued to take poetry classes and fiction classes, but it was never my major. I was always a film studies major or a comparative literature major.
Why didn't you go into poetry?
I really wanted to be a filmmaker. And film had been a love of my life since I was, since I was able to watch moving images, basically. And I didn't major in English in college because I took one English class and it was a survey of British literature in the 18th century or something. And I was this is horrible. I never want to do this. This is sucking all of the things I love out of literature. So I kind of turned my back on it. But I really loved bringing that same energy to film. So that's why, being in film studies was the right place for me. I did go to grad school for creative writing, and I filled in my literature deficit at that point. But I always appreciated how the creative writer looks at writing versus how the scholar looks at writing, because in creative writing, you know, we look at a poem, it's like we turn it upside down to see how it was made and try to understand that craft. So that I loved, but I did not want to talk about William Blake and all of the secret coded messages that are in one of his poems. Like, that to me, no, pass.
So was there a point that you had to decide that you weren't going to be a filmmaker? And was
there
that
was.
Like killing, crushing to your, like, your soul?
Not really. I mean, after I graduated, I looked at working in the film industry, and I was going to start as a production assistant. And the first thing I was told is the hours are long, the pay is low, you'll have no control over your life. And at that time, it just felt like really incompatible with what I needed. I needed money, first of all. So I wasn't afforded the luxury of someone covering my expenses or anything. So so that was one part of it. I started to think long and hard about if it was a career path I could even start on. And then I thought about how many people are involved in making a movie. And I was like, I would much rather work alone. And that decision happened. I was trying to decide between going to grad school for film or creative writing. And that was kind of how I pushed myself to creative writing, was having full control over my destiny by working alone.
And you had already been writing poetry. So then you decided to go straight
into that. Yeah. And, I don't think everyone needs to get an MFA. I think I certainly did, in part because I had such a deficit. I hadn't read a lot of 20th century poetry, so I filled in a lot that I loved. I loved learning, and just having those years to write and be horrible at it. I think everything in my life I have now, from my job to the books that I publish, I credit with that MFA experience that I had. So, you know, on the one hand, I feel like I couldn't get here without it, but I do want to be clear that I don't think everyone needs that that same experience.
And with the blogging, because I'm very interested in the history of the internet and how it intersects with literature. When you were blogging at the time, wasn't that like one of the first times that, like, as a grad student, you now have this voice for yourself, and you found like another community of writers who maybe weren't being published and they had their own voices?
Yeah, it was such a, it was such an important time for me creatively. So I don't even know how I discovered that poets were blogging, but it was as I was wrapping up grad school and about to head out into the world and thinking a lot about, well, I'll say that a lot of the people that I went to school with had already left the institution. I stayed on for an extra semester. So at that point I was working with, you know, people who weren't in my cohort, and my cohort had moved on. So I was really craving that kind of creative community that I'd enjoyed in my program, and blogging provided it in such a beautiful, a really beautiful way. It was, that community was non-competitive. It was mutually supportive. People were really curious and people were smart, and they were blogging about things that they were smart about. And I mean, some of those poets have gone on to have tremendous careers, like Amy Nizuka Metatil was one of those bloggers, Victoria Chang, C. Dale Young, you know, like Eduardo Corral, like all those people have just done amazing things. So that community, I think, was really nurturing to a lot of people.
Did you find a gay community, or did you find a lack of a queer community?
There was a queer community too. So even of the people I just mentioned,
okay,
you know, C. Dale and Eduardo are both queer poets. But one of the questions that came up a lot in this community was, what does it mean to be a queer poet? And should you move into that identity, or is it an identity that you should you be a poet first and a queer person second? You know, like that was a lot of dialogue was about that, but it was also a very different time for queer people. Mm-hmm. You know, the mid 2000s, there's still a lot of progress yet to be won.
It seemed like even if in your writing, like when you're an undergrad in college, it seemed some of the writing and the stories that you were sharing, like you went to this meeting where you met like this this guy that you guys were putting like pins on your shirts or something to recognize that you're gay, and then you found your like a boyfriend through that. And like through my experiences, that just seemed like more progressive, even at that time period than it is like 10 years ago or it is right now.
Yeah, the university was a really protective bubble at the time. And I think that university in particular, I wrote about a couple of the really formative events that happened. Like the morning I woke up and they had wheat pasted posters all along this pedestrian bridge with queer people from throughout history, mm-hmm. just kind of claiming them as queer, and how revolutionary that act was at that time. And how I joined the Speakers Bureau for the LGBTQ Center on campus. And I used to go to residence halls and fraternities, and I would basically be on a panel where I talk about how I discovered I was gay, how I came out, and then people would ask me questions. Reflecting on that now, I mean, I think it's important that that happened, but now, like, thinking about that now, it was like almost like being in a human zoo and like inviting people up to the cage to interact with me. And but I think that those moments were really critical for fostering understanding and kind of demystifying what it meant to be queer in those years. So I don't regret it, but now it seems so foreign that something like that would have happened because of all the progress that's been made.
Mm-hmm. Did that embolden you through speaking?
I mean, I'll say as a person,
or do you regret it?
I don't regret it at all.
Okay.
But there, it's a complicated question for me because of some of the issues that I cover in the book. I think on the one hand, it made me feel that it was very important to be publicly queer in mm-hmm. my life whenever it was safe for me to do so. So I tried to move into every work experience I had with that identity on my sleeve. But, you know, it didn't fix my own relationship to queerness, which is the weird part of it, I think. So on the one hand, I may have appeared like a confident queer person, but inside I had like tons and tons of emotional issues from how I had grown up trying to hide that part of myself. And I think it really did take decades to unpack all of that. Mm-hmm. And I hope I'm in a much better place now. I mean, I feel like I am with a lot of those issues and questions, but and of course, at the time, if you would have asked me that question, I would have been like, yes, I'm super confident. I know who I am. I know what it means to be queer. But like, there was a lot of internal work that I had not done about what it meant to be like vulnerable in a relationship with another man. You know, like those were really challenging parts of it.
How do you unpack those internal issues?
Well, a lot of therapy.
Yeah. You just have to go through them.
I think a lot for me, it's been a process of, you know, as I participate in relationships, romantic relationships, really understanding how I'm reacting to things and questioning those reactions and then trying to understand the kind of reactions I want to have. And sort of then building a bridge between the goal and where I'm starting, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I have not been, I'm 35 now. I live with my parents. I was a dropout from college, but then I've gone back and I take classes every now and then. I've not been in a romantic relationship. I just have like, I feel like I've been in friendships with heteros that like reflect the ups and downs of like a romantic relationship, if you know what that I'm mm-hmm. talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's why in one of your pieces in the book where you think you're going to have maybe a relationship with a teacher, and there's this part where you guys kind of like almost break up. It was very powerful. And to me, and it was like this moment I really like related to.
Thank
when
you.
This the teacher realizes he's not going to be hanging out with you anymore, possibly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is a very complex relationship. And I think people might look at it and say like, well, this is clearly inappropriate. I think at the time we may not have even had that much awareness of the power dynamic, but that story does really invert who is doing the harm and who is harmed. And I say at the end of that chapter that I was the villain of that story. I believe that's true. I mean, I had like set out to like capture this guy, you know, like that was my goal. And I think I wasn't mindful of the fact that that was a human being with feelings. You know?
But like, you're just a kid.
It's true. I was an adult. I was an adult. I was a 21, 22 year old. I didn't know better, but I think as I reflect on it from the position I'm in now, and it's been 20 years, but I feel bad about those choices I made. And I think I'm also fortunate in that nothing happened between him and me. So I don't have, there's no like emotional wreckage for me in all of this. Like I really felt like I just kind of cut things off with him and thought that that would be okay. But I also remember feeling in that moment how surprising it was that he might have been hurt by my choice, you know?
Was he queer?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, he was? Oh, I didn't pick that up.
Yeah, that, I mean, that whole department was gay men and women.
have you ever talked to him again?
No, I haven't. I think he's
reaching out.
No. I mean, I don't know that he'd remember me, to be honest. I don't want to assume that was as formative an experience for him as it was for me. But I think he's retired now from teaching, so that I do feel I one thing you may have noticed in the chapter is that I did a lot to kind of cloak the real information for the reader, because I don't think the reality of who he is or what he's doing is of relevance to anyone anymore. And I didn't want people, you know, Veronica Marsing his real identity and contacting him. So, you know, names are changed. I didn't mention the university. I didn't mention the program name correctly. You know, like a lot of those things I did to protect his identity and his privacy, because as far as I'm concerned, he didn't do anything wrong. And I also don't want to invite a conversation about what happened. Like, okay. The lesson that I took for it is mine and doesn't really involve him anymore, you know?
Were there other things that happened that you didn't mention?
No, not really. I mean, okay.
I felt the story was pretty harmless. I've heard like other stories with that power dynamic that's a lot more troubling and problematic. This one seemed pretty harmless to me overall.
I think it was because nothing happened, but had I not met the man that I dated for several years in the middle of that interaction with my professor, I don't know what would have happened. Something would have happened, I believe. But
you really do think that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I met the guy that I dated, you know, just weeks before the professor's Christmas party, which in my mind would have been the moment that we consummated whatever attraction was between us. And since I did not go to that, and then I broke off, you know, a future commitment to have an independent study with him, which I actually did, you know, intellectually, I wanted that experience of working with him because he was really brilliant and I respected his expertise.
You've worked in college past this. Have you seen that happen again, but not through your own experiences, but stories you've heard?
Yes, I have.
Do you think that's a big problem in like colleges?
You know, I think it's something that is solely the responsible, and this is going to be in complete conflict to what I wrote in the book, but I do think that it's the responsibility of the person with authority not to engage. One complaint that I have about a lot of depictions of workplace romances on TV and movies is that the HR department is like never present. And it's like, this is a key policy that every company has. Like, why aren't you clearing it with HR? I don't know. I feel like that's maybe a little literal for some people, but that's really where my mind goes. And in real life, I have seen people fall in love with their professors and get married and have kids and have families and have great lives. And you know, I think that's wonderful, but I also think that it's such a slippery slope for people that there's such capacity for harm to be caused to one of the people involved. And I think that's dangerous.
So I wanted to go back to this idea of you making a film. Have you thought about, or have you written a script, and have you, after writing all this stuff, the poetry in this book, are you going to ever go back and try to make a film?
I don't know if I'd ever try to make a film. Okay. I just don't have the expertise to do it. I think I have the dream, but I don't have any of the skills. So I respect the people who can do it, and I would much rather put you know, a story of mine into the hands of another capable person. I write across genres. So really, I will try everything. I've written, you know, like a pilot for a TV series idea that I have. I've written a feature film script. I'm not saying that they're good or even producible right now, but like I have that interest. And I studied screenwriting in undergrad with, what's his name? He was so great. he wrote the movie FX and a couple other movies.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah. I'm so sad. I'm blinking on his name right now because the professor's name that I seduced, that was stuck in my head now. But so I learned screenwriting from him. I did study film even as I was studying creative writing in grad school, because as you may have seen on the blog, you know, film theory and film form became just such a key part of how I write anything. Mm-hmm. So to me, film is always present in my work. I think Slice of Life is the most literal presentation of that, where movies are in the work. Mm-hmm. It's something that it's always an idea that's rolling around in my head. Like, how can I be more filmic with what I'm writing?
When you were writing this book, did you decide early on that you were going to split your life from the movies? Did you ever have a point where you started writing the movies into your life? Like, it started becoming fluid?
No, it always had this like this element of braiding to it, where I was pulling the stories together. most of it I just discovered in the course of doing it and trying to figure out what I could do to keep the reader engaged and connected without. The real struggle was not providing just like plot summary of the movies for people who hadn't seen it, but really trying to dive deeper into those things so that I could get to like themes and symbols and the parts that were really resonating with my own story.
Yeah, the Scream one was really good. Like, there was the moment when you turn the TV around for like the audience to hear like the moans and groans of these like Matthew Lillard and like this other guy like stabbing each other to like represent like homosexual like sex. I was like, oh my god, this is brilliant.
I really did that for my senior project in college.
Yeah, have you are there other films that have made you like think that deeply of like sounds like that?
I think sometimes I watch a movie and I just, I mean, a conversation I have to have with a lot of people now is like, no, I don't watch movies with this like deep intellectual perspective. Like, I watch them to enjoy them. And I think I can both appreciate a movie for the enjoyment that it provides, but some movies I do want to think more deeply about. And sometimes that adds to the enjoyment that I have about the movie. Like, I hate the movie The Little Mermaid, the original animated. The live action was a little bit better, but what I do like about that movie is talking about how horrible Ariel is and why I think she's the villain of the movie, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I looked in your book in the back of all the films you mentioned, and none of them were, you had no Disney films. You not like Disney? Or it doesn't have an impact on you?
How to answer that question. Growing up, Disney movies were, you know, absolutely a part of my childhood and something that I loved as a kid. I started to age out of them. I think The Lion King was probably the last one I saw in a theater. Wow. And then after that, like, very little interest in seeing anything new that came out, except for some Pixar movies, which I think are a little different. But I mean, the early Disney movies are what I feel more of a connection to.
That's cool, because I know like a lot of people are like way too into Disney.
Yeah, especially in Southern California, it is it's its own queer community around Disney.
Oh, for real? So in the book, when you're writing one essay, are you sure about what film you're going to use, or did you take one film out from one essay and apply it to another?
I never did that. I almost always paired the experience in the movie up on the first try. The only the only essay where I didn't do it on the first try was the Western essay. I hadn't seen Westworld. I'd seen the TV show version, and I loved it. But I knew that it was based on a 70s movie. And so as I was thinking about the story I wanted to tell about being in Tombstone on that particular day, I thought, you know, the story wasn't really about Wyatt Earp, which is what I had initially, I was going to use the movie Wyatt Earp. It's too literal. But when I discovered on that tour that Tombstone had been like the Las Vegas of its day, and the labor there were so rich and everyone was trying to get their money, like that really resonated with what Westworld was talking about. And our obsession with gun violence as a culture right into that too. So I think all of them matched up really easily for me. I picked movies that I felt like I knew well. Mm-hmm. Westworld was an exception. I did have to watch that a couple times, but it's a relic of its time. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
And the only movie in the book that I don't like is The Neon Demon. But I still use that because the story that I was telling was such a quintessentially Los Angeles story, about media and about being looked at, and about wealth and privilege. And I felt like The Neon Demon was in conversation with all those ideas. It was just doing it so wrongly about Los Angeles that too was an important part of that story that I was telling. You know, the difference between expectation and reality. I was living, but that movie was getting super wrong.
Mm-hmm. Are there any movies that have just come out that make you think? Because there's a lot more queer movies that have come out, I think. Mm-hmm. But they're still so behind, I feel like.
It's probably always going to be that way. There's two kinds of queer movies. There is the movie that is made by queer people for queer people. And then there are movies that queer people embrace because they mean something to us. Like The Devil Wears Prada and Mean Girls are two that I would lump right in that category. But a movie that I felt was really queer and really well done was Love Lies Bleeding, which came out earlier this year with Kristen Stewart. It has a very bizarre moment in it that I kind of wish wasn't part of the movie, but aside from that, I thought it was awesome. Mm-hmm. And it was great to see these queer women being so fierce and so powerful.
I just saw this movie Challengers, and it's supposed to be like a lot of queer people are like celebrating it. I'm like, it is queer, but it's also like not really. It's more about friendship, like we were talking mm-hmm. about earlier.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it yet, no. Oh, but I have seen all the memes about it.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever been into meme culture coming up?
Well, I mean, it's not native to my life. You know, memes, when I was in my formative years, I mean, the internet started when I was 18 for me.
Yeah.
So I did not have a childhood on the internet. It was all post that. But memes used to be text-based, and it was something like surveys you would fill out, we called memes. But I mean, now I love memes. I think they're hilarious.
I was going to ask you, when you're like going back to your blog, sorry, you're in the world of poetry. This is like around the same time that the alt-lit era begins. You seem to be outside of the alt-lit era. Did you see that take off and you decided you're not going to be a part of this? Is that weird to see something take off?
When you say alt-lit, do you mean
like Tao Lin, HTML Giant?
Oh yeah, no, I mean HTML Giant was like definitely, you know, on my radar and part of the poetry world at the time. So I think what we saw in that period with things like HTML Giant and its peers, that people were taking the means of production because they had suddenly been democratized and very affordable for people to use. So online journals popping up was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But even in my MFA program, one of my professors was like, don't publish your work on the internet, like always publish it in print. Otherwise it's not going to be respected. And like that, of course, that philosophy has been turned on its head now. It's, I think, more advantageous to the writer to publish on the internet because your work can become shareable on social media and you can reach so many potential new readers that way.
Mm-hmm. I think that was the case when I was an undergrad at OSU. I'm like, from like 2011 to 2013, 2014, that was still a thing. They're like, don't be on the internet. You're going to be cheap. No one's going to pay any attention to you. And I feel like that's really, I feel like it resonated with too many of my peers. They're just, I don't ever see put out any work from the undergrad years. So that just may be because they're also disinterested in writing after your undergrad years.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely seen a lot of the people that I came up with be less visible, or I'm not seeing their work as often as I used to. And the poetry world to me feels like a pyramid, and the base of that pyramid is, you know, the widest. All there's, there are more first book contests than there are any other kind of book contest. So what we're doing is we're creating these on-ramps for people to start a career, but then there's not a sustainable way for the, for a lot of people to remain in the career. Like, if you can't get your second book out, what do you do? Like, how long should you wait? How long should you try? And those are really tough questions. For me, there was a 10-year gap between my first and second book of poetry. And I did definitely question, you know, if this was something I should keep doing. The only thing that kept me hanging on was that I had published chapbooks fairly regularly in between. So I felt like, you know, there was something, I was doing something that people were responding to, but like my book just wasn't breaking through for some reason. So I'm glad I was patient with it, because I'm super happy. You know, my third book came out from the University of Akron Press, and they're amazing. So I'm so thrilled to be working with them. And but even my second book's press was also amazing. Tinderbox Editions, loved working with them. Yeah.
I saw you started a lit mat called like Locust Point, where you're trying to like create like communities on the internet together. Have you thought about starting your own press?
Always. I love to start things. I love coming up with ideas. Everyone that I work with now, they joke that my job title is head visionary, because all I do is dream up new ideas. But Locust Point was an idea that I had. I think I was maybe nearing the end of grad school, and I told someone about it. And once I had said it out loud, I was like, oh my God, I think this is such a good idea. And if someone else did it, I would be really sad. So I forced myself to get it up and running, and I did it. I would say, you know, half of the work I did alone. I was managing the website, corresponding with the authors, getting their proofs. You know, I was the managing editor basically. And then I would ask poets to be volunteers and to find seven poets in their city who would give them five poems each. And then I would publish, you know, I always like to read, like to have a depth of reading experience with poets. And one thing I hate about lit magazines is you might get one poem from a person, but I'm like, I really like, I'd love to see like a bunch of things. So I really get a sense of who they are and what they're doing. And Locust Point was dedicated to the idea that poetry community is everywhere. And the other thing I wanted to do with it was demystify and democratize those things, so that people who had never had access to poetry community could find, you know, the resources in their own city that they could track down and get involved in, or, you know, here are seven people, eight people, including the editor, that you can reach out to and make friends. So yeah, I'm really proud of that work. I really enjoyed it. I think it just, at a time of my life, it became just too hard to balance everything. So I kind of set it aside, but I've never taken the website down, because I know a lot of the links are out of date for those different cities, but I love the poets who are there. And a lot of those poets have gone out to do amazing things too. So it's so cool that like Locust Point got to be a little stop on their journey. I always fantasize about starting it up again, but I don't know if I ever will.
Well, it's a very interesting idea, because you're connecting the internet community with very real regional communities. I feel like those two things, for me, they're always very separate and they're distinct and apart from each other. I know for myself, I'm more interested in the internet literary community than I am in the one in Tulsa, but it's also because I don't know really people in Tulsa all that much. I guess if there were a site like that, it would be a lot more easier to connect to people if there was like a Tulsa location on your website. I think it'd be very interesting for you to start back up again at some point.
Note taken.
Yeah.
One thing I would have to do, the technology that I was using is so out of date. Like I was hand coding that website. And now of course there are any number of platforms I could just move it to, but again, moving everything means rebuilding everything from scratch. So that's one of the things that's kept me doing it again.
How long did it take you to learn like coding?
Not long at all. I learned some of it from a summer job that I had when I was in grad school. So I learned the basics. And even in the early days of the internet, I experimented with having like an online journal, like a blog before we had that word. And so I was hand coding a blog on the little web space that the university gave me, you know, as part of my tuition and fees. So I learned the basics, and then I learned how to use Dreamweaver, which at the time was sort of the standard for building sites. but then CSS started to come along, and that made things a lot more complicated. And I started to reach the end of my understanding of what to do.
And when did you get into podcasting? Because I know you have a podcast.
That's a great question. I think I started listening to podcasts in earnest when I started working at UCLA, and I suddenly had a very long commute, and I loved them. I especially love things that let me indulge kind of my obsessions, like Slayer Fest 98 was one of the first that I got really into. It's all about Buffy. They watched every episode from the beginning. And I just, you know, that was really enjoyable to me, and I loved hearing people's perspectives on things. So the first podcast I started was one that I'm still doing called The Right Process, which I coordinate through UCLA. And I just invite a writer on, and I have them talk about how they wrote one project from concept to completion. Because I think every writer's journey is unique. There's not one way. I think it's great for aspiring writers to hear that, you know, someone wrote a whole book scribbling for 15 minutes while waiting for their kids to get done with soccer, and like that's possible. You can do that. I think the lesson of that podcast is really you can't stop. You can't, you have to do it. Like, you can't give up on yourself or your book, and that's how you succeed. That's really one of the most important qualities that you need to have as a writer is persistence. And then my friend Giovanni and I, during the pandemic, started a podcast about America's Next Top Model, which was so much fun. In part because Giovanni is an encyclopedia of that show, and he just knows everything, he remembers everything. He's so sharp. He knows a lot about fashion because that's the industry he works in. So it was so much fun to do that show with someone who was such an expert. Whereas I was merely a fan, you know, I had watched the show religiously when it was on and really loved it, but Giovanni just, like, he was such a great partner for that. So it was one of those things that it's I mean, I respect what you're doing. It's a lot of work to do a podcast and to keep it consistent and do the editing and all the promo you have to do. So it is a lot. It's a big undertaking.
Who, what's the most like unexpected guest you've had on that the right process? Like, have you had anyone that you're like, oh, this person's rich, all they do, it must be so easy for them, but then, like, you're surprised by their process?
I think every person I've interviewed has had an element of surprise for me. I feel like I've learned a lot by hosting that podcast, honestly, about how to write and how to keep writing part of your life. But, I mean, I've had everything from a person who got the first agent they ever queried to take them on as a client. Like, that never happens. But then that person also, like, when they were out on submission, they queried almost every publisher before the last one they took bought the book. So it's sort of like there was that balance there. That's what I think about a lot. I think it's interesting to talk to TV writers because their work is so collaborative, and they get, like, their colleagues and their boss are, like, up in their work all the time, you know, and they have to do so fast. So it's interesting to hear how they balance all of that with their own creativity.
Do you want to talk about, I see you have a framed picture on your wall of your poetry, Nanopedia.
Yeah.
Do you want to read a poem from that?
Sure.
I think I bought that through Small Press Distribution. I used to buy, like, queer books through them.
You know what? I actually don't have a copy of it handy.
Oh, that's okay.
But let me find it. It'll take me just a sec.
Okay.
There's a poem I love from that book that is always fun to read. Okay, here we go. This is called Online Dating. What you pull from the water will love you. Mermaids, manatees, a muskellunge, you name it. Mermaids are lovely, but make poor company over time. Their fins end up ruining automotive upholstery and fine linens. Don't ask how I know. The muskellunge, while impressive to your friends, will suffocate in your arms. Your love is star-crossed. You occupy mutually exclusive worlds. Manatees are such sad little beasts, hovering near the surface of the water where propellers mark their thick, dull skin with ruts. This is the epitome of love. Though you scratch them, they'll not wander off. They want to be with you, even in silence, even not touching. To know you're there is enough for them. To know you exist is enough.
That's really good.
The art you're seeing behind me, that's my friend Faith Christensen Smeets painted that. I knew her when I was at ASU, and she went on to do a lot of visual art, and I just thought that was kind of a I was drawn to it because I felt like it was a melting American flag.
Oh, wow.
And I thought that really captured the spirit of the book because it's a lot about like the perception of America.
I always ask, all these poets, when do you know you're finished writing a poem?
Well, when someone takes it,
Yeah.
that's one barometer. I don't know. That's a really tough question. I always have to let my poems sit for a long time because as soon as I write them, I think that they're amazing. And that's not true. But I've learned a lot about revising my poetry just in the last couple of years. I've really changed my strategy. And so now I do like really radical revisions when I write. It just takes me a while to get through that process because the poem has to get like bad to me again before I'll go in and be ruthless with it. So honestly, it probably takes me a couple of years to make sure my poems are done, but I try to write pretty regularly to make sure that I just always have like a huge receptacle of work.
I was listening to a podcast by some poetry friends, and they were saying like their favorite poems are always the last ones that they wrote. How and why did your strategy change when writing your poems?
Well, I think part of it was I would look back at my older work, that even work that was in a book, and I'd be like, oh, I wish I would have changed that, because the book is the artifact of the writer you were and never the writer you are. So I'm hopefully always going to be a better poet than I was when I wrote the last thing I published. And over time, that difference becomes more apparent to me. And that part of that's because I'm really dedicated to just like evolving creatively with my work. So I don't know. It was time for me to take bigger risks with my work. And I think burning a poem to the ground and leaving like three or four lines behind that I was going to start to build a new poem from, I wanted to try it. And then I felt like it was so invigorating. The poems that I was developing were, they felt brand new. They felt like better iterations of ideas. So I'm going to stick with that process until I feel like it's not serving me anymore, but it's been great so far.
Would you ever rewrite like Nanopedia into something new?
No, I would not, but I had always envisioned Nanopedia being a multi-volume project,
Oh,
and
wow.
that's not an idea that I've let go of. So when I had originally written Nanopedia, I'd written like 150 poems, and whittled it down to, I think, like the 65 that are in the book. And it's something that's not, it's an obsession that's never left me. So I think I will come back to it. I'm not there yet.
Would you ever take anything from your old blog and rewrite that?
Maybe, because I was all over the place on that blog. So I think you might see some connections. Like in my very first book of poetry, there's a whole section that's, it includes an essay about the movie Vertigo. And I'm sure I was blogging about Vertigo at some point, you know, and like those ideas were taking root in the poems. My relationship to what appears on the internet now is really different. So if, which is partly why I don't blog like I used to. Although I missed that process because I felt like blogging was so good for my creative output.
Do you ever feel like you have to perform or put out at a certain aesthetic or level because maybe you went through an MFA or you work at a college, or maybe you have to censor yourself?
Censor, yes, to some degree. Well, I don't, it's not necessarily because of my job, but I think, and honestly, like I feel very vulnerable putting this memoir out into the world because it does share some things that are vulnerable for me. And I think I like to be, at work, I like to be sort of just like the best version of myself, you know? I mean, I have avoided writing too explicitly about sex. But that's also something I've challenged myself to do. So I do have like a bunch of poems that are what feel like explicit for me. So that's part of the work that's like never really gone anywhere. So I wrote a bunch of these poems. I was really, really dedicated to the idea. I was working toward a collection that I was thinking of calling Human Vending Machine, because that's what, you know, that's what like Grindr looks like on your phone. It's like a bunch of snacks and you just press the button of the one that you want and it drops down. So that was kind of the conceit of the sequence. And it was, you know, informed by real life experiences I had when I was a single person. But it just, I don't know, those poems didn't land with people. So, and that's cool. I think I learn a lot from everything I write, whether or not it gets out into the world, you know?
Oh, that makes sense. Do you feel like because you're gay, you have to talk about sex maybe?
No. I don't feel like I have to. But I am paying attention to, I think, the next generation that's come up behind me in poetry. And because it's been such a challenge for me as even as a human being to really embrace that. So, I mean, I look at it with curiosity and I really want to understand what that the meaning of that work and what it's like to do that work. So in that way, I feel like it's not just the people who are ahead of me who are my teachers. It's still the people who are coming up behind me that are teaching me about what it means to be a poet and how to write well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I'm kind of prudish and uncomfortable talking about sex in my work as well. I see people like, can you point to like people that you were saying like that are coming up behind you? Like I see people like Tommy Pico, who's very open about sex. And then I see Brandon Taylor, who maybe he doesn't talk as much about that subject.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brandon's work, I think, and I've read Real Life, and there's sex in there.
Yeah, there is. There
along with Tommy, you know, the whole that whole podcast crew, they're all owning that sexuality in a way that I really admire. And you know, folks like Chen Chen, Sam Hirschelwine, the two folks that come to mind immediately, Jason B. Crawford. Yeah, I mean, it's the queer poets who are coming up are, and not to say that Chen Chen and Sam Hirschelwine are coming up, they're here. But yeah, I just have a lot of admiration for what they're doing. There's a fearlessness to how they write that I'm trying to learn for myself.
Are there any elders that you also seek out? I saw on your blog you mentioned D.A. Powell, who I've talked to.
He's amazing, and his work really shaped me. C.D. Wright was someone whose work changed the way I thought about writing.
Claudia. Oh, really? C.D. Wright? Did you read, God damn it, what's that called? The long poem with the light.
Deep Step Come Shining?
Yes.
Yes, that's amazing. Amazing. Love that book so much.
Awesome.
Yeah, and she was an incredible woman as well, on top of being a great poet. Claudia Rankine is probably another one that I would point to as showing me that writing can be so much more than I ever thought it was. Richard Sykin's book, Crush, I think is something that I'm like people are going to be talking about that book for decades. It's so brilliant. And again, fearless. So I think a lot of the people that I admire in writing, I perceive as being very fearless in how they approach what they write about.
What you said, you had written some very vulnerable things in your book that you were maybe afraid people seeing or reading. Can you point to specifically what those were?
Yeah, I mean, the Black Swan chapter is probably the most vulnerable I feel about the book, in part because I think it's really the low point of the book and probably my life, to be really honest. And so one thing that's always been really important to me is my reputation. And I feel even weird talking about this because it feels so, there's like a level of insincerity that it may sound like it has, but like I've always really cared that people saw me in a positive light. It's hard for me if people think negatively about me, which is crazy to even say out loud. But Splice of Life was so important to me, not just as a writer, but as a human being, because it was really the first time that I felt like I was putting all the cards on the table and being like, look, I'm a mess. And I, you know, things might look good on the internet or when you talk to me because I don't share everything that I'm going through, but like, you know, I had suicidal thoughts for 30 years that I could not control. And I also did not know that that was something that I shouldn't be having. It just seemed like it was normal for me. I assumed it was normal for everyone, but, you know, fortunately I've moved on from that. I think expressing that I have body image issues, I mean, that's not revolutionary for any queer person at all, but I also have an awareness that like most people would consider me to be like good looking or that I am in good shape. But like the self-perception versus the public perception has always been, and that's probably where this is all rooted, is that I've always wanted my public perception to be the idealized version that I would want myself to be, even though that's not the reality. All right, so that was like, that was 20 years of therapy in a 30-second clip.
Do you want to speak to about your mom and like her journey?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, I touch on my mom a couple times in Spice of Life, but of course I don't talk about the most important experience, which was her illness and passing. And partly I have written about that a little bit, but it's still something that I think I'm understanding, but the lessons that I've taken from my mom have been very important to me, and they continue to be something that's top of mind. So I've written a lot about, you know, how she once said that money is not the currency of life, time is, and like how radically that changed how I thought about how I was living. And that was an incredible gift to be given the easy way and not the hard way, the way that she learned it. But my mom was an immigrant, and she had a very conflicted relationship with that experience and that identity. No one knew, I think, in adulthood that she was from another country, because a teacher, when she first moved to America and as she was learning English, a teacher made her talk with marbles in her mouth, so she had no accent. Jeez. And yeah, it's very wild. So my mom sounded like she grew up in the Midwest, but she did not. And on both sides of my family, the majority of my extended family lives in Europe still. And I have relationships with my mom's relatives there. I've seen them several times throughout my life. Some of them are coming here in July to do a tour of California, so I'm excited to connect with them. But you know, it's because I was the only person I knew who had a mom who was an immigrant. Like, I didn't really understand the common experiences I was having as a first generation child in this country. But now that, you know, there's a larger dialogue about it, I see so much resonance with how my mom raised me and what her expectations of me were, and how those lessons have continued to shape me. So it's been really enriching to hear other people's stories.
If you could hang out with her for a day, like where would you guys go and what would you do?
We would go to the movies. That was something we did a lot when I was growing up. We would always go to the Dollar Movie Theater together. We would have some Belgian food. There was a restaurant that I used to live near in Phoenix that served Belgian cuisine, and we went there a lot as a family. I would ask her to make waffles for me because she was the best at doing it, and I, to this day, I'm obsessed with waffles. And I think we would probably go shopping because we both love a good bargain.
What shop would you go to?
Well, I would want to go clothes shopping, but I'd probably go to something like Williams-Sonoma with her. She was a great cook and she really understood tools. So some of the best cooking tools I have to this day were gifted to me by her. And, you know, they're treasured possessions of mine. So I would love for her to continue to help me on my journey to be as good a cook as she was.
What are some of your favorite moments with her?
Well, whenever I was alone in the car with my mom, she got lost. Mm-hmm. even where we grew up and where we'd go all the time, I think one of her weird traits as a person was that she's like, I'm going to avoid this traffic and take a shortcut. And of course, this is before GPS and all of that. So we would be, you know, we would pull up to a stop sign and she would just look at me and be like, I don't know where we are. And that happened multiple times. She had a great laugh too. So, that most of the stories that we tell about her now are the times that we really upset her and how she reacted to them. Like when I came home with my eyebrow pierced, that was probably a textbook Maria Jensen moment. She didn't notice it at first because I had glasses on. So I walked in and I gave her a hug and she's like, oh, it's good to see you. How are you doing? And she's chatting and she, all of a sudden she just stopped and her face like froze. And she said, is that in your eye? Oh my God, is that in your eye? And then her voice like shot up three octaves and she's like, don't even look at me. And she like walked away. She was so mad. But I reminded her that when I was growing up, she said, as soon as you're 18 and out of this house, you can do whatever you want to your body. And let's say I did. I pierced it. I tattooed it. You know, I dyed my hair. I just went wild. So although she had given me that permission, I think that she regretted planting the idea in my head.
What would you say to her if you could talk to her right now?
Oh, just that I miss her so much and I wish that she was still here. Part of our relationship was really challenging, and I think that was like my adolescent years because I was going through a difficult time and so was she. And so I wish that we had been able to have more time to talk through those experiences together, because I think by the time, you know, she's going through treatment for her illness, she had really discovered what it meant to be happy. And of course, I was so thrilled to see that for her, but I wish the cost hadn't been so steep that she had been able to give herself that joy sooner. So I don't know, you know, those are the, and I would love to talk to her more about like what it was like to grow up in Belgium and just to have a closer connection to that part of our ancestry, because losing her meant that I lost that connection too.
How did she discover her happiness through her treatment?
When she thought she was going to die, she realized that all of the things that she had worried about didn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I think like that's another like really important lesson, that, you know, if you live your life with an awareness that you're mortal and this is all going to be over, and it may be over sooner than later, you're just not going to defer the things that make you happy. You're going to pursue the things that you want. And also just, I think she just loved herself more at that point too. I think she stopped being so hard on herself, and that was probably her worst quality.
So do you live your life that way now, trying to?
I really try. I mean, like I said, the things that I have taken from her, particularly in those years, are things that I think about every day. And that's how I think I honor her memory, is by honoring those lessons and making sure that I don't leave this world with regrets or that I don't waste time being unhappy. But, you know, when I look at Spice of Life, I do have some grief about it because I'm like, look at how much time I wasted not loving who I am, not believing in myself, and letting people hurt me. And to what end? You know, like, they didn't feel any better about it, and I didn't either. So I think, you know, it's almost like a backdoor into confidence in a way of like, there's no reason not to, to really, you know, love and respect yourself.
Do you need to go?
Yeah, I mean, this has been a great conversation.
Thank you for coming on. Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate you reading my book and giving it thought and asking me these great questions.
Ken, one more question. Maybe it's too long of one. If you could talk about your friend that passed away, is that too long of a question?
Do you mean Tori?
Yeah.
No. What would you like to know?
That moment where you found out that he had taken his own life, I feel like that really impacted me because I've been reading these weird, like, this book called, like, Faces of Suicide about parents that are writing about their kids who've passed away. And the first volume was, like, really not that good because it's, like, these people who don't know how to write, but then the second volume was pretty good. But I was just thinking about, yeah, these people that are thinking about, that are impacted by suicide.
Well,
did that, like, impact, like, because you were talking about the Black Swan and thinking about suicide.
Yeah.
Did that impact you to, no?
No, that's the wildest part of it, I think. So obviously, you know, Tori's death was devastating for a bunch of reasons. I was mad at him when he died. So, of course, I have to carry that guilt for not having let go of whatever, you know, grudge I was carrying. It was very shocking. I never thought Tori would take his own life for a second. He really loved being alive. You know, he had such a zest for living. And I think, you know, as I was grieving, I felt so much responsibility. There's like a, like, the thing that I kept feeling that was so uncanny was that I felt immortal. And I don't know a better way to describe it, but like, someone that I had been so intimate with had died, and it was like, you know, part of me had died, but I was still alive. And so there was like survivor's guilt, but then there was also this like feeling far too powerful for a human being. And that grief was crazy grief. Like, none of it made sense. That's why I think pairing it with The Descent was the best way to capture what the experience was like for me. It was just a maze, and I was trapped. In terms of like my own suicidal thoughts, you know, like, no, I never connected them. I never connected that experience with what it might be like for me to inflict that grief on other people, because the thoughts were, I don't know if I can even talk about it articulately, but like, I didn't connect that act against myself as harming people that I cared about. And I think people who commit suicide, I don't know that they are thinking about those things because the pain that they're going through is so intense. And that was one of the questions I had about Tori. You know, it's like, didn't he know that people cared about him? And I think one of the moments of illumination for me in that grief was my brother telling me of like, yes, he knew, and he still felt that he had to do this. So that's how hard it was for him, you know, like, and that perspective, as dark as it is, was very comforting to me. But there, I never really thought about committing suicide myself as being, I don't know. I just, they were never the same thing. When it happens in Spice of Life, it's the only time I ever vocalized it in my life. So like, that's the other part of it. Like, those thoughts had never come out my mouth. And saying it out loud was also an uncanny experience. Hearing myself say it out loud, like, didn't sound like me. That's really what made me realize that I had a lot of work left to do. Because I was carrying around all this baggage for so long, And I had just grown so accustomed to the weight of it that I didn't know that there was another way to live. And I am very grateful that I no longer am troubled by those thoughts.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm all the time. So I probably should go to therapy.
I mean, I started taking a mood stabilizer during the pandemic because I was alone, you know, all the time. And that's what did it. So yeah, I mean, but I have talked to other friends who have like those persistent thoughts as well. And they're not just persistent, but they're banal. Like they like come into your mind and it's just like, I have to go to the grocery store. Maybe I should kill myself.
Yeah.
I can't forget to clean up my room. You know, like, but it's never like a compulsion. It's not like an urge necessarily. It is really a thought, and it's bizarre to experience it even. So yeah, so you're not the only one.
Okay, well, thank you for coming on.
Sure. I really appreciate this time and your attention.
Thank you. This is awesome.
Take care.
We'll see you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.